Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 24th of February 2023, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. We are concentrating on British history at the moment. We've been doing so for the last dozen or so episodes. We've gone through the early Britons, we've looked at the Romans, we've looked at the Saxons, and now we're going to head back to the Welsh again for a little bit more Welsh history after we've just covered Alfred the Great. And of course, I have with me today my co-hosts, Truthvids from truthvids.net and Patriot from the Patriotic Arts Community. Truthvids, hello, sir. How are you doing?
Yeah, all good. Looking forward to another Patriotic History.
Excellent, excellent. Patriot, how are you doing?
Hi, Sven. Yeah, I'm good, thanks. And yeah, likewise, looking forward to another episode.
Yeah, I did enjoy doing Alfred the Great and revisiting all the things about Alfred and what made him so good. And this next character that we're really going to be looking at, he's fairly new to me, but he's fairly big in the Welsh histories. Hywel the Good, or Hywel Da, he goes by. But we've got a little bit more of British history to go through first before we get to him. And we'll be using R.W. Morgan again, and we'll also be using Wikipedia. So we'll start with R.W. Morgan. He says, Alfred was succeeded by Edward the Elder, who left the throne in AD 925 to Æthelstan, celebrated for his victory at Bamburgh over the confederated Danes, Scots and Norwegians. In Cambria, Igmund the Dane invaded Anglesey and was cut to pieces with all his army by Anaruid at Maes Eon Melion, and Anaruid died AD 913. And obviously Anglesey isn't in the part of the country that we call Cambria today. Cambria was really another name for Wales. And when Wales became smaller, the northern part of it was still called Cambria, and that's why we've got Cambria that's up in the north today. So Anglesey is obviously North Wales. It's the little island that sticks out in the north of Wales. It had quite a lot of importance to the Druids, and Wikipedia actually has a fair bit of information about Anaruid and about Igmund. They say Anaruid made an alliance with the Danish king in York in an attempt to guard himself against further Mercian attacks. After that alliance proved unsatisfactory, he came to an agreement with Alfred the Great of Wessex, visiting Alfred at his court. He received honours and gifts from the Saxons, and King Alfred stood witness at his confirmation. According to Alfred's biographer Asa, Anaruid used his new Saxon allies to help in repelling a raid by his former Danish allies around 894, and to ravage Cadell's lands in Ceredigion and Eastrad Tui the following year. Around 902, an attack on Anglesey by the Danes of Dublin under Ingimundir was repulsed, and Anaruid died in 916, succeeded by his eldest son, Idwal the Bald. So we have confirmation here that it was the Welsh that went to Alfred because they did want him to be king. And when they took Alfred as king, they received honours and gifts, and King Alfred stood witness at his confirmation. So you had a strong alliance there between Alfred the Great and between the Welsh here, both of them united, fighting against the Danes. And I do find it interesting that there was a confederation there that Æthelstan beat in his victory at Bamburgh. The Danes, the Scots and the Norwegians were all sort of ganging up together to fight against the successor to Alfred the Great in Wessex. So quite a lot of interesting things going on here. Treefoods, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, you see that the Danes are relentless, right? And this would probably include all Scandinavia, because the Danes were from all over. They're constantly attacking, and these Christian nations keep driving them back. So the Danes keep getting defeated. And then later on, they would actually convert to Christianity and become far stronger and end up with a North Sea empire, which ruled all Scandinavia and England under Knut the Great. So much for Christianity making you weak. It actually made them a much stronger force to be reckoned with, right? And as for Alfred, some people dispute whether Alfred was the first king of England, because technically there was a little chunk of England he didn't have right at the north. And it was actually his grandson, Æthelstan, who finally got, you know, what we would call modern, you know, territory of England. And they say, no, it was actually Æthelstan who was the first true king of England. But regardless, Æthelstan had everything built up for him by his two predecessors, Edward the Elder, Alfred, and he was finally able to conquer it all and have the full England. So I just wanted to point that out, that, yeah, I'm aware of that. Because some people might say, well, no, Alfred wasn't the true first king of England. But, you know, just so you know, Sven.
Yeah, well, he near enough was. So basically, Guthrum was an outlier. Guthrum the Dane that became Christian with all his men. And once he had died, the Danes began attacking England again, trying to take England. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, just a point. I just did a quick look up on Cumbria, and it means in Welsh the people, and it's pronounced Cumbria, and it's apparently supposed to reflect Cymru, which is the Welsh pronunciation Cymru, and it sounds very similar to Cymru, doesn't it?
So, yeah, it does.
So that was quite interesting.
Yeah, well, that must be where the name actually comes from. It shows you that the Cymru or the Welsh, they were all the way up there in the north as well. I mean, originally they had the whole of England and the whole of Wales going up to where the Picts were in Scotland.
Yeah, so it's interesting. Obviously, since Alfred passed away, I just wonder if a lot of people saw it as an opportunity, since, you know, there would have been maybe a bit of a power vacuum. And maybe that's what sparked a lot more of the additional conflicts and wars and other, you know, tribes to try and gain some of that power.
Well, I can imagine that would have happened. Yeah, there would have been a power vacuum. So it would have invited in others to like try and take away parts from the kingdom. And this was quite an important attack by the Danes upon Wales. It was a big attack, and the Welsh managed to repel them. Ingimundir, also known as Hingamund, Igmund or Ingimund, was a 10th century Viking warlord. In 902, Irish sources record that the Vikings were driven from Dublin. It is almost certainly in the context of this exodus that Ingimundir appears on the record. He is recorded to have led the abortive settlement of Norsemen on Anglesey before being driven out from there as well. He appears to have then led his folk to the Wirral Peninsula, where the English allowed him to settle his followers. Ingimundir's invasion of Anglesey may be the most notable Viking attack in Welsh history. And one thing that is interesting is that in Wales, there are various islands that have actually got Scandinavian names. So they were given Viking names, which sort of implies that they must have had Vikings there for some time. Yet what we see happening here is that the Vikings were sent packing, basically, from Anglesey. And then what we see is that there were still parts of England that were sparsely settled. And the English must have thought, well, it's a good idea just to let them settle this area. And then they can start farming and they can populate this area. So it wasn't all negative and warfare between the two groups. And it also shows that the Vikings were running Dublin at that time as well. Any thoughts on this, Truthfitch? Do you know anything about this period?
I just know that it was relentless, constant raids. I don't know much about, you know, the raids on the Welsh, but I do know that they were just everywhere, even, you know, all around Ireland. Nowhere was really safe. Some people have linked, you know, the Danes to the tribe of Dan, which I thought was worth mentioning, that there is a prophecy that the tribe of Dan would... Well, it's kind of ambiguous, but it says they will cause the horse to fall on its back. And you can see that all these nations, they're constantly falling, causing them to tumble backwards. But you can see that it's forcing these nations to get themselves together to form Christian alliances and essentially become better alliances. So even though these Dane attacks were relentless, it did have a positive effect that it united the kingdoms together under Christianity. And then the next part in that prophecy is, "Oh, I have waited for thy salvation," implying that the Danes would actually convert to Christianity and they would be one of the last tribes to convert to Christianity. And that is true, right? There was, I believe, the Balkans were just after the Danes, but pretty much Scandinavia was one of the last tribes to convert to Christianity. So I just thought I'd point that out as well.
I think you might have meant to say the Baltics there. They were the ones that the Teutonic Knights
went in. Yeah, the Baltics. Yeah.
I get confused between that. I'm always saying Balkans instead of Baltics. They're both very similar words there. Also, the tribe of Dan, I think they say that they gave their name to the Danube, the Dnieper, and the actual word Dan appears all over Europe, basically showing that this tribe of Dan went everywhere. They're also the Tuatha De Danann, the tribe of the Dan that ended up in Ireland. Their name just appears all over the place. And of course, we have them today as the Danes. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, the Dan, the tribe of Dan was their emblem was the snake, wasn't it? Because they were to leave a mark wherever they went. And, you know, as Truth Vids has a lot of vids on that. It's very interesting. And so, like you said, we see that in the, you know, in names and stuff, wherever they traveled, there are often things named after them, such as the Danube, Danmark, Sweden, and so on. So that was, it's quite interesting, or very interesting how it ties together.
Was it the snake in it within an eagle's claws, or was it just a snake on its own? Do you know, Truefids?
Well, the tribes in Israel, they were split into four groups, and Dan was the head of one, and they had the eagle symbol. So you had, you know, the eagle, the man, the bull, and the lion, and the eagle symbol was the head over those three. So yeah, it would make sense that it would also be the eagle clutching the serpent, right?
Because that is a symbol that we still see today, isn't it? That's a part of heraldry. And I think that may have been the heraldry that was on the signature of the letter that was sent...
The Spartans.
To the Spartans, whoever it was. There, the Spartans sent it to the... priest, the high priest of Jerusalem, saying that our records show that we are the same people as you. We're brothers, basically. And the seal that was on that letter was an eagle and a snake, according to Flavius Josephus, who claims that he's actually seen it. So that shows you how far back these symbols, these heraldic symbols go. Well, next we will have a look at Huel Da. Here, Idwal Vol Anaruid's successor was slain with his brother Elis fighting against the Danes in AD 940. Hweldar, his successor, codified the British laws, introducing such modifications as the altered national circumstances of the Cymry demanded. And what he means by that is because the Cymry were then living in Wales rather than in England. The laws of Hwel are by far the greatest literary work of the Dark Ages in Europe. And of course, R.W. Morgan was a great patriot, and he thought that what the Welsh did was just absolutely the very best out of everyone, basically. So we can see that really does come through in his writing, how patriotic he is. But this made me think, well, we should really have a look to see what we know about these laws, because it was really the first time that I'd heard of them was reading about them in R.W. Morgan. And Wikipedia, surprisingly, does have a lot of information on these laws. They say Huelda, sometimes anglicized as Howell the Good or Howell ap Cadel, who died 949-950, was a king of Dehubarth, which is Pembrokeshire, who eventually came to rule most of Wales. He became the sole king of Cecilig in 920, and Cecilig is where we get the Silurians from, this earlier tribe that we heard about when we were fighting against the Romans. The Silurians were a famous tribe. Caradoc or Caractacus was the head of that tribe, and Cecilig is what they were named after. And shortly thereafter, he established Dehubarth and proceeded to gain control over the entire country from Prestatyn to Pembroke. As a descendant of Hrodri Mawr through his father Cadell, Hywel was a member of the Dinafur branch of the dynasty. He was recorded as King of the Britons in the Annales Cambriae and the Annals of Ulster. So we can check this information with the Irish records as well as with the Welsh records. Hywel is highly esteemed among other medieval Welsh rulers. His name is particularly linked with the codification of traditional Welsh law, which were thenceforth known as the Laws of Hwaldar. The latter part of his name, Dar, literally means good, and it refers to the fact that his laws were just and good. The historian Dafydd Jenkins sees in them compassion rather than punishment, plenty of common sense, and recognition of the rights of women. Hwaldar was a well-educated man, even by modern standards, having a good knowledge of Welsh, Latin, and English. And again, this follows on from Alfred the Great collecting all the laws together and writing his laws, and it being noticed that they were tempered by mercy because of Jesus Christ's mercy. So rather than an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, it was instituted that you were able to take a fine rather than having to take a limb from somebody. So it was tempered by mercy. And that's the same thing that was noticed about this, with this compendium of the Welsh laws. This Dafydd Jenkins sees in them compassion rather than punishment. So I guess it's a big topic, really, law. And we started off with the laws of Molmutine, the King Molmutine, which was supposedly, I think, either 600 BC or 300 BC. And next we hear of the Saxons collecting these laws under Ine, and then Offa, then Alfred the Great. And then here we have Hwaldar collecting essentially pretty similar laws together. So I think these laws that he introduced or collected together would have been very similar to the Saxon ones. And we also have, going all the way back, we have what are called the Welsh Triads. And we talked about some of them when we did an episode looking into the Druids. And we talked about some of these laws that were a part of the Triads then as well. So all of that sort of kept evolving as common law continues to evolve. It's basically set by juridical judgments, and it's still evolving today, the common law. And this is where it was at 1,000 years ago. So I think it's quite an interesting subject to get into. Any thoughts on that, Truefitz, before we start getting into these laws?
Yeah, you see that the best kings always had good laws, because that made a great civilization. And if you don't have good laws, it's essentially just law of the jungle, right? Just strong might is right, and then the strongest can just do whatever he wants to weaker people, and laws is what stops it from just descending into chaos. And that's why the best civilization have the best laws. You'll always see every nation that became a great empire, they initially started with a moral civilization with good laws, and then from there they went on, and you know, it might have went downhill from there, but you have to have that moral standard to start, right?
Well, that's what a king was for, wasn't it? He was for being a lawgiver. And I like the fact that we have this symmetry here. We have Alfred the Great and we have Hywel the Good. You know, both of them were exceptional kings, the Great and the Good. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
I think King Alfred must have inspired a lot of the other kings to for them to want to emulate what he did right, you know, so... And they probably wanted some of that glory as well, and they recognized some of the things that he implemented. And I think that kind of helped to pave the way for a lot of the laws to be embraced elsewhere and within their kingdoms and under their kingship.
Yeah, I think Alfred the Great was an archetype following another archetype. He was wanting to be like Solomon and wanting to be wise, and in doing so and in setting that example, he became another archetype for other kings to live up to. Well, notable features of these laws include the collective responsibility of kindreds for their members. So families would be responsible for the behavior of their individuals, or rather like a nation being held to account for the behavior of its individual parts. The gavelkind, inheritance of land amongst all and only male descendants. And we've talked about that before. And that's a bit unfortunate, because you end up with the descendants, each time somebody dies, the land gets split and it gets smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. Whereas the other way of doing it was to say that everything would go to the eldest son. And that ensured that wealth got transferred down the generations. And it also meant that the other brothers would have to go out and find some new land for themselves. And you know, eventually that led to us conquering the new world, going out to America, going out to Australia, because there wasn't enough land for us here in Britain. But this system, I think, was a better system when everything went to the eldest son, because that did encourage the other brothers to go out and conquer and set something up for themselves that they could then pass down to their descendants. If you have a system where everything is split up equally between all the children and you've got 10 children, then there may not be enough land at the end of that left to actually do anything with it. I think it's better to keep everything together. There is also a status-based system of blood money. So that was rather like the Wergeld that Alfred the Great had. Rules for slavery and serfdom. Obviously, it wasn't just black Africans that were slaves. Slavery was a part of our civilization, basically, right up until the time that we abolished it for black Africans. The inability of foreigners to naturalize earlier than the fourth generation. And obviously what they're talking about, foreigners here, are essentially people of the same race, but of a different ethnicity. So if you had like the Danes, for instance, or the Saxons, it wasn't for four generations that they could actually call themselves Britons, basically. So quite a long time. You think, I guess a generation, maybe about 50 years at that time. So four generations, maybe 150 years, 120, 150 years to go through four generations. So, and they actually had laws that govern this, whether somebody could be naturalized. And of course, today we just say anybody that sets foot in the country can be given a British passport and then call themselves British. Very, very different to what we had back here. And this would have reflected what the way that the Saxons did things as well. And also a very lax treatment of divorce and illegitimacy that scandalized the non-native clergy. So clearly the British church, the Britonic church, was happy with the rules that they had here for divorce and what a legal marriage was. But the Roman church were not happy about it. So you see, there was a difference there. Even at this time, there was still a difference between the Celtic Church and the Roman Church. Any thoughts on this overview here, Truefids?
Yeah, I just want to say, first of all, almost all laws are based on religion, right? And most of them come from the Bible, and that's where they form their basis, and that's where they have their authority, because they're divine from God. And that also means that they're unchangeable, because God doesn't change. Whereas now we've went completely the other way, where the government gives the laws and it changes all the time, right? And it's getting horrendous now. And I just wanted to comment on each one. So that collective responsibility of kindreds, you know, you used to, if a child misbehaved, you used to be able to go to the parents and, you know, have a go at them and shout and say, you know, what the hell is your son doing? Destroying my... whatever, you could actually hold the parents responsible, whilst now you can't do that. Kids can just do whatever they want. And you see, you know, at night, it's, you know, kids going around and you know, you get gangs and all that. And it stops that, right? When you can hold the parents responsible. And that's why it's deliberately made so you can't. The inheritance of the land in the Bible, you at least made sure that the eldest had a double portion, so more than the others, and then whatever's left you could divide amongst the other males. So I guess it was kind of in between what you're saying. The females didn't get any inheritance, and that was because you wanted men who had their own, who were established, to marry your daughters. You didn't want them to marry your daughters just because they're looking for a cut of the inheritance you're going to leave him. You want him to marry the daughter because they just want the daughter and they have their own property and they can look after her. You know, that's why only the males had this, had the inheritance. And, you know, if you gave all the inheritance to your sons, they're more likely to be able to go and get, you know, good wives because they're established as well. The slavery and the serfdom, that's the same in the Bible. You know, you never used to have this prison system where if someone commits a crime, well, then we collectively will pay them, you know, 10 years to keep them going. It drains society. Rather, they would be put into slavery until they've paid off, you know, what crime they've committed if they couldn't pay it. And that really deterred people from wanting to commit crimes, right? And also the that fourth generation thing, lastly, that was also in the Bible, that if an Israelite married an Adamite, so a fellow white person, only on the third generation would they be counted as an Israelite. And that was to make sure that they obeyed the laws and kept the same culture of your country, rather than it your nation starting to convert to another culture of all these foreigners, right?
I think we see where they would have a problem with the collective responsibility today. They wouldn't be able to do it because there are so many single mothers. And back then at this time, you couldn't hold a woman. A woman couldn't be taken to court. How are you going to punish a woman? I mean, that would be so uncivilized to punish a woman. So women couldn't be taken to court. They couldn't testify because they didn't have any testicles that could be chopped off if they were caught lying. You know, that's something that people say as well. So if you had single mothers, you wouldn't be able to have this collective restitution on the parents, because you wouldn't be able to punish, you know, the woman, the mother, for the behavior of the child. So, you know, we can see that by these changes that we've brought into society, we've just messed everything up. Because you couldn't really have that today. You couldn't have this collective responsibility because you would have all these single mothers that you would be trying to hold to account for this. There's a topic we could talk about for ages, I should imagine. Patriarch, any thoughts on these laws, this overview of the laws here?
It's interesting to think that they say 200 years. I mean, that's well above, you know, their lifespan. So I think it goes to show, you know, they had great expectations for future generations to uphold these laws, you know, so they must have seen them, you know, somewhat kind of eternal and, you know, really something that's deep-rooted and permanent, you know. And also just a point on the daughters. I think the daughter was the inheritance, wasn't it, really? It was the property of the daughter was the property of the man or the father, and he would give her away. And I think she was the inheritance for another man to marry. And from that daughter, you could, you know, attain wealth, and a high value woman, I guess, would create high value children and sons that would go on to, you know, bring more wealth back to the family. And today's governments, I mean, in terms of power structure, it's all inverted, isn't it? They just change laws based on status quo and are constantly pandering to ensure that they're just kept in power, in a position of power, where they can do a lot of underhanded stuff.
Yeah, I think we can see from the naturalization part there, just picking up on what you were saying there. I mean, if you got four generations before you could become naturalized, it shows that the people whose society it was understood the great value that it had in having a society that actually had laws, that had a commonwealth, that was all working together. And somebody would have to work hard and show they were a good person for four generations before they could join that society, before they could become naturalized and be called a member of that nation. Unlike today, where it's just handed over for nothing. The fact you had to wait four generations show that they really understood the great value that their people actually had and the society that they had built. Well, the laws include the laws of the court, the laws laying down the obligations and entitlements of the king and the officers of his court. So that's interesting. So by this time, the king actually had obligations. This is what the king has to do, and this is what the king is given in return, his entitlements. And then there was also the laws of the country, which dealt with every other topic. In some versions of the laws, some of the material in the laws of the country are split off into the Justice's Test Book, dealing with homicide, theft, and the values of wild and tame animals and other items. Within each of these sections, there are tracts of varying length dealing with different subjects. For example, the laws of women and the law of contracts. Civil law differed from most other codes of law in the rule that on a landowner's death, his land was to be shared equally between his sons, legitimate and illegitimate. This caused conflict with the church, as under canon law, illegitimate children could not inherit. And again, this is interesting because, I mean, years ago, marriage was the Marriage Act. And whoever you had consummated the marriage with and you had had children with, they were your children. So the Celtic Church was still going by that. I mean, obviously, that's the child, so the child should be able to inherit. But then we had the Roman law that said that it's only people that you've literally been married to with the church carrying out the ceremony and all the rest of it. And that's what the marriage is. Whereas a biblical marriage is the act itself. It's not the exchanging of rings. It's not the contract. It's not the ceremony. It's not the reception afterwards. It's literally the consummation of a marriage that actually makes somebody married. So therefore, the Celtic Church was not seeing any difference between so-called legitimate and illegitimate children, because if there was a child there, it's obvious that a marriage has taken place, isn't it? If there is a child there. So you can see where this where this difference came from. Truthfids, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, just off the top of my head, what's the verse in Genesis? A son will leave his parents and cleave to a woman, and they will become one. That's what marriage is, and now they've become one, they've unified, and whatever children they have together, they're their children. There's no priest or whomever. The whole marriage ceremony that gives some man who wears some special clothes in a special building power over you, because you're only husband, wife, if he says so, when in reality, if you lay together and then that's it, you're married. And a lot of people have a hard time with that these days because the way things have gone, where men and women go out on dates and hook up, and they find it hard to imagine what all those people I was with, they were all my wives at one point. And yeah, they were, but we shouldn't have been living that way. That's kind of been, our society has been corrupted. We never used to be that way, and we shouldn't. You should just seek a partner and live with her for the rest of your life and raise children and teach them to be moral people and to serve your people, right? That's how it should be, right?
That's also why when Jacob Israel, he was tricked into marrying the sister of the woman that he wanted to marry. And because the wedding night had taken place before he realized this, the marriage had been consummated. Obviously, it was in the dark, and the sister must have been very similar to the sister that he wanted. That marriage then had to be honored because it had been consummated. That was the actual marriage there. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I guess the only grounds for an illegitimate child then, from the perspective of Celtic, would be if one was already kind of married to another woman, and then it was on the grounds of adultery. I mean, would that surely disqualify that child through that illegitimate line not worthy of inheritance?
Yeah, I would have thought so. That would come under fornication. Fornication was sex that was outside the law of marriage, wasn't it? So fornication would be race mixing. Fornication would be also be having sex outside of marriage. Adultery, that would also be fornication. And the law for what a marriage was that it had to be somebody of your same flesh type and your same bone structure. Because it says flesh of my flesh and bone of my bones. And that's marriage. And that's defined with the first marriage between Adam and Eve. So anything outside of that is fornication. So if you married somebody that was of a different flesh type and a different bone structure, i.e. somebody from another race, then by the biblical standards, that was fornication. And as we talked about in the last episode, and the offspring of that, which was called in Hebrew a mamzer, that was translated as a bastard. And what we would say today would be a mixed race individual. But the old terminology was mamzer or bastard, which was implying that the offspring came through unlawful sex outside of marriage. And what it means is sex outside of the lawfully defined marriage in the Old Testament, which is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. So you can see the way that our whole ideas around marriage, around what is legitimate and illegitimate, that has all changed. And I think at this time here, 1,000 years ago, we can see that in the Celtic Church, it was still who you had sex with. That's who you were married to. Whereas in the Roman Church, we can see that the ceremony itself had started to take over. And I think you could actually just write the names down in the Bible. When you did actually get married, you would write the name down in the Bible, and that would be a record of who had married who at some point, sort of later on than this, because obviously it would have been difficult for the peasants to hire out a church and have a wedding ceremony and all the rest of it. So you just used to write it in the back of the Bible or in front of the Bible, I'm not sure which part, and that would actually be your record of your family tree. Moving on to this other section of this, once a case came to court, the method used to come to a decision was usually by compurgation. Under this system, the person accused or the parties to a dispute would give their version under oath, following which they had to find a number of others who would also take an oath that the principal's oath could be trusted. The number of compurgators required depended on the nature of the case, and the judge or judges would then come to a decision. And I guess we should really stop there as well, because this is interesting too. I mean, this is where the origin of the, you know, where you need 12 good and just men on a jury, where that actually comes from. And this compurgation, I mean, if you were a good person who is known to be an honest stand-up person, and you gave your oath and you said this is what happened, and then you would get other members from the community that would step in and basically say, yes, he's a good person. He's an honorable person. If he tells you this is what he did, this is what he did. And then by the weight of the numbers of the people that you have that are backing you, that was more important than anything else, which is, again, a totally different way of doing it today. And obviously for the nature of the crime, that depended on the number of people that you actually had to have to come and say, yes, this person is an honest chap, and, you know, he wouldn't do what he's accused of, is effectively what was going on here. So it all depended on how you had interacted with society, how you had interacted with your community. If you've been an upstanding good member of the community that helped everybody out, you wouldn't have any problem with getting people to say, yes, this man honors his oath, he wouldn't lie. Whereas if you were, you know, a bit of a dodgy character that hadn't helped out the people in your community and you got accused of something, then you weren't very likely to have people that would come in and stand up for you. And that I believe is the origin of where we get juries from. Any thoughts on that, Truefitz? Have you heard of that before, compurgation?
Yeah, I believe that was also part of the Bible, that you needed witnesses. You needed two witnesses to establish if a crime had been committed, right? And you know, that's why there's four Gospels, just to point out that Christ had four witnesses, so it's true. But yeah, there used to be a time when people really lived on their word, right? They really took it seriously. You know, nobody lied because it was seen as, you know, scandalous to be a liar. And you know, there even was a time when policemen could just testify and people would take it very seriously and not think, or police wouldn't lie. They would all be seen as upstanding citizens, whereas now they all need cameras and nobody trusts them unless they can see it, you know, on that camera they take around on their coat. Nobody trusts them anymore. And you can see that today, you know, we have a society of mistrust always, right?
Yeah, I think they used to say if somebody lied, their words had fallen to the ground and, you know, it would bring a curse upon them. And you can see, I mean, back then, say the law against sodomy. So you had this law against sodomy. You had capital punishment for sodomy. But unless three people had actually caught somebody in the act, that law wouldn't actually come into play. And it's similar, obviously, with the Islamic laws. And I think in Qatar, remember when they had the football cup recently, and you had all these people, or BBC and the rest of them, saying, "Oh, Qatar treats gays terribly. It's against the law and all the rest of it. And we should all be protesting against this." And, you know, there was nothing to stop gay people going to Qatar. The law was that they shouldn't be engaging in gay sex in public. You know, it's the same thing here, that if there were three witnesses, then the law would come into place, because three witnesses had actually seen you breaking the law. It wasn't that, you know, they were against people or anything like that. It was literally if you get caught in the act. So, you know, people may say, well, how barbaric that they had these laws. But in actual fact, it meant that if people were going to engage in that sort of thing, it had to be done out of the public way. It had to be done, had to be done in private. I've gone a little bit off topic there, but Patriot, any thoughts on this?
Well, I guess just it just shows you how cohesive and united the societies were back then. And like we've said already, the value of someone's word was worth a lot. And I can imagine how it would have helped to just shape society in general. You know, and people were very conscious of how they acted around people, because they knew that they were highly valued. Their actions, the things they said, would have been of high value in public. And, you know, people would vouch for them, or they wouldn't, I guess.
So you got the fact that people aren't going to lie anyway, and then you've got this oath that people are taking on top of that. And then you got people that were backing you up. You know, the whole system and the whole society was so different to today. Capital punishment was only prescribed for a small number of crimes. Homicide was usually dealt with by the payment of compensation to the victim's family, while theft could be punished by death only if it was theft by stealth and the thief was caught with the goods in his hand. And the value of the goods stolen also had to exceed 4 pence. Most other offences were punished by a fine. And that's interesting. I guess they were looking at if somebody ends up dying in homicide. I mean, it's not saying murder here. It could be manslaughter. I guess most instances would have been a fight. Whereas if you got theft here, then you got, you know, there should have been no need for theft, because you had Christian compassion, you had Christian charity. If you wanted something, you'd just ask for it. And the nobles had to provide it, because they had this noblesse oblige. So to steal something by stealth, I guess, would have marked somebody out as being, you know, of a wicked kind of person to be doing that, I guess. Any thoughts on this, Treefitz? Homicide and being dealt with by compensation, and stealthy theft with capital punishment?
Well, yeah, they had no toleration for burglary, right? That, you know, if you pop out and you come home and your house has been ransacked, or you know, you caught the person, you had a right to defend your land. That's always a key principle, that you're defending, you know, your property, your wife, your kids. You were allowed to defend, and now they've deliberately done away with that, because they want us to be helpless, basically. And, you know, you see all those videos in America where people are just walking into shops and just, you know, ransacking them in broad daylight and walking out, and the security are not allowed to touch them, right? So we're heading towards anarchy, right? But it's all deliberate.
That's also interesting. I mean, the way I used to look at these things, I used to think, you know, so if somebody's been shot by the police and all they were doing was stealing something, you know, how much is a person's life worth? You know, and all they were doing was stealing a piece of property that may have been worth a few hundred dollars or something. And the person's been shot and they've died and they've lost their life. you know, that was the way that I used to look at these things. But when you think about it, for the good of society, you have to have a very strict punishment so that you can leave your doors unlocked, so that you can trust all the rest of the people in society not to do this. And I think you've got a similar thing with Islamic law, where they cut your hands off if you get caught thieving. And of course, in Islamic countries, you can leave the door unlocked. You know, nobody's going to steal from the shops because they know that there is this strict punishment that will be the response if you get caught stealing. So again, it brings up these interesting ways of looking at ethics, because you would think, well, somebody's life, you know, it's so valuable, it's worth far more than any property. But then if you do that and you have these, you know, you don't prosecute things like theft, then you end up with a situation, as you pointed out there, Truthfeeds, in California, where you have people just walking into shops and loading up bags and then walking out of them, and the security guards doing nothing about them, because the security guards know that if they lay a hand on them, that's assault, and they'll be prosecuted for assault. So they just have to let people walk out. And of course, you certainly can't leave your house open in California. Any thoughts on this topic of theft and capital punishment, Patriarch?
In terms of laws in relation to a society in general, I think obviously they had strict laws, and our ancestors had strict laws back then, and it helped to condition us and to a point where, you know, these laws were written on our hearts, you know, and it kind of become like a second nature. And I think perhaps over time, maybe because it was just expected, they became more lax. I don't know. But in general, when the problem is when you take people from a culture that still needed those laws to perturb them from the certain crimes or acts, and then you suddenly bring them into society that is used to just doing these laws or abiding by these laws and by second nature, because it's, you know, built into us. This is why there's so much kind of surge in knife crime and rapes and stuff, because they're not in their natural habitat or under their own natural law, which is like a symbiotic relationship between the culture and the people. You know, the culture and laws are reflective of the people and their natural nature. So I think that's why when these people, a lot of the migrants come over here, they just run riot.
Yeah, they're used to needing to have a strict hand to keep them within order. And then once they come to a European country where we don't have such a strict hand anymore, because we can rely on people just to understand that if they do things like that, society will break down. And then they can end up running riot. Well, the first part of the laws deal with the rights and duties of the king and the officers of the king's court, and the order of precedence is set down. First the king, then the queen, and obviously the Saxons, or at least in Wessex, they wouldn't allow a queen, so that was a difference between the Saxon laws and the Welsh laws. Then the etifed, or the edling, the heir. Next come the officers of the court. The Yorworth redaction identifies 24 officers of the court, of whom 16 are the king's officers and 8 are the queen's officers. First in rank was the captain of the household troops, then the priest of the household, then the steward, followed by the chief falconer, the court justice, the chief groom, and the chamberlain. So you have a whole hierarchy here. And this rank here, the captain of the household troops, Arthur I was the captain of the household troops, but he was also the prince to the king, I seem to remember, when we were talking about that. So some of these officers' ranks could actually be held by the princes. A list of additional officers follows, including such officers as the groom of the reign, the porter, the bakeress, and the laundress, and each officer's entitlements and obligations are listed. So it shows you hierarchy was really important here, and you had a whole court here, a whole thing, a whole system that followed around with the king wherever the king went to. It also introduced a number of legal terms. Sarhad could mean an insult or injury, or the payment that was due to a person in the event of an insult or injury, and this varied according to the status of the person concerned. For example, the queen or the idling's sarhad was one-third that of the king. Galanus was a form of wergild and represented the value of a person's life in the event of a homicide and was set at 3 times the sarhad, although the sarhad was also payable by the killer. Derui was a fine payable for crimes, and Kamlaru was a smaller fine for less serious offences, whilst Ebiduu was a death duty payable to the deceased's lord. Sarhad and Derui are still Welsh words meaning insult and fine, respectively. So an insult here would have been an insult to your honour, not like insults that we think of as an insult today. So it shows us here that that was seen as grievous as an actual injury, an insult to your honour. So this shows you that they were extremely honourable people. They're not talking about microaggressions here or anything like that. I should imagine something like an allegation that your daughter had been sleeping around or something like that. That would have been seen as an insult to honour here. And also this, going by the rank of these officers of the court, if one of these officers of the court was killed, there was a certain payment that had to be paid, the wergild. So they had this same wergild system as the Saxons did. Any thoughts on this, Truefids?
Yeah, you didn't have all modern conveniences back then, like supermarkets and all that. You know, a lord or a king, if he was traveling around, he needed to have someone who could cook for him and bring clothes and wash and you know all that. So it sounds like over the top and luxurious, but you know the lords and kings were traveling around a lot and seeing to their kingdom or whatever territory they had. So yeah, that was just the way it was. And yeah, as you said, it was if you insulted someone, called someone a coward, that they could get a fine or they might even request a duel to the death or something like that. I believe that's just how it was, right?
Yeah, honor was seen as very important. They were honorable people. And we can see that with the oaths that they had and this expectation that people wouldn't lie. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Not really. I haven't got much to say on this bit.
Well, that's all right. It's basically it's talking about the fact that they had payments for insults as well as injuries.
It's quite surprising that, to be honest, actually. It's hard to we're kind of there now, aren't we, with insults online, and you've seen it on social media, the police are kind of knocking on people's doors because they might have insulted someone's feelings. So I don't know, I'm kind of at odds with this. I don't know. It's hard to see. I mean, I can see how there was a threat to the honor, and obviously words had power and the more substance back then. But then, if we say it's okay for that time, then how can we say that it's not okay to police it in this day and age? That's where I'm just conflicted.
Well, it was an individual thing back then. And today it's like the state will say, well, we're taking offence on behalf of this group here, and therefore you're going to be punished for this. Whereas I think the origins of what was going on here, it was to prevent there being a duel to the death. You know, somebody had insulted your honour, you would then want to have a fight with them. Instead of that, you could say, look, this person said this in the court, and then you could get some money back from him. You could get some compensation. So I think it was probably more to prevent these duels to the death and that sort of thing. But yeah, I should imagine they would probably try to refer to this today. You know, when you say, like, this is ridiculous, all these impingements on free speech and all these speech laws that you have, microaggressions and all the rest of it. And they could probably say, oh, yes, but there was fines for insults back here. But that was when there was seen as an individual victim of the insult whose honour had been degraded in some way. And that person who was the victim of the insult then had to take it to court, and they received some compensation for it. And the other option to that was to have a fight over it. So I think it was a way to avoid fights, and certainly wasn't things like microaggressions today. Well, while Welsh law lays more emphasis on the powers of the king than the Brehon law of Ireland, this is still restricted compared to many other codes. As Moore comments, Welsh law fell into the juristic category of Volksrecht, the people's law, which did not lay great stress on royal power, as opposed to the Kaiserrecht or Königsrecht, the king's law of both England and Scotland, where it was emphasised that both civil and common law were imposed by the state. So Welsh law was more about the people, and the king was there to he had to keep the law as well as the people. And eventually, I mean, this did make its way into the Saxon law, didn't it? Because that was what happened at the Magna Carta, wasn't it? And the Saxon kings and the Norman kings had to obey their own laws, which I think is obviously a Welsh influence on those laws, or a Welsh influence rather on the Normans and the Saxons. For the purposes of the laws, Welsh society was divided into five classes: the rulers, including the king over his kingdom, and the lords over their fiefs; the free Welsh, including both the pedigreed aristocracy and the yeomen together; the Welsh serfs, or foreigners resident in Wales, so they had the same status; and the slaves. The privileges, penalties, and obligations due by law varied with the social status of the person concerned. So we effectively had five classes or castes there. And you can see you've got the slaves right at the bottom that were made up of the same people. But as you pointed out before, Truthvids, they were criminals, basically. They'd broken laws in some way. And the punishment was that they would forfeit their right to be a free man for a certain time. And also you had to keep family trees, because you remember when the Druids were there, they had to show that their family, they've been free men for 10 generations going back. So this class here of the free man, the free Welsh, that's just underneath the king there, that is a status that people kept and were still referring to like 1,000 years later, because you had to show that your ancestors had all been free men going back 10 generations in order to be a Druid. So and the free man included the pedigreed aristocracy and the yeoman. So if they had broken the law in any way, they would have ended up being a slave, and that would have been recorded. And then those 10 generations would have been zeroed again. And somebody would have had to, again, show that he has 10 generations back, all free men, before he could become a Druid. So I find it interesting that there's five different castes here within society. Not based on race or anything like that. It says here foreigners, they had the same status as the Welsh serfs, obviously until they'd been in the country for four generations, and then they could become naturalized. Any thoughts on this little class system that we have here, Truefids?
Yeah, it just shows you it certainly wasn't too bad. Obviously, when the Normans came, the free people ended up almost becoming serfs, right? And that's what caused all the resentment between the natives and the Norman overlords. But eventually, things improved again, right? You weren't even allowed to leave your territory. You had to stay in your jurisdiction, and you were bound to the lord of that place. But here we see that everyone... if you weren't a serf, you were basically a free man, free to, you know, go wherever you want, work wherever you want, and do what you want. And this is more closely following the Bible. But it also shows you that they always kept records of who was foreigners, that they knew and you couldn't just, you know, after 10 years, shrug it off. You had to have several generations, as you said, but now that's all gone, right? The quote unquote British, that just means anybody who's got some kind of citizenship, basically got a passport or whatever, when there it was actually in your blood back then.
Yeah, and we'll have a look at what the laws were for the foreigners in a sec here. Patriot, any thoughts on this little class system that they have here?
I just wonder how after Alfred, who obviously made education ready available to everyone, how it would have kind of intertwined together, and would they have worked together? Given were people able to change their caste, or did it have a bearing at all? I'm not sure. What do you think?
Well, I think parentage probably would have played a large part, and where it says here the pedigreed aristocracy, because obviously pedigree is who your ancestors were, and obviously the royalty here as well, and the lords, that would have been to do with ancestry. But then you've got yeomen here that is also with the pedigreed aristocracy, and I should imagine you could become a yeoman. There's probably a way to rise up a class, as it were, because you could stop being a slave, and then obviously you could rise up to being a serf again, or you could be a serf, and I think you could rise up to being a yeoman. But right at the top, you had the aristocracy and the monarchy. That was all by ancestry, because it says here by pedigree. I mean, that's just from looking at this and trying to work it out. I'm not too certain about the definition of the word yeoman and how that fits in, but it does seem to me that what it's saying here is pedigree, it race or ethnicity, ancestry, that is what determined the top two classes in the society here. And that's similar to the caste system in India. I mean, that was ancestry. I think you had the Brahmin caste and the warrior caste, the kingly caste, and then the farmer caste, and then right at the bottom you had like these untouchables, and that was all based on ancestry as well. But there wasn't any way to transfer between one caste and another, because it was all based on ancestry. But we can see here that the ones right at the bottom, the slaves, obviously you could go from being a slave back to being a free man again. So obviously you could move between the classes here. Well, at the time of Hywel's laws, Cymru, the modern Welsh for all of the Welsh people, apparently only applied to the free classes and not to the serfs or the slaves. However, none of them counted as a foreigner, and even if they moved from one Welsh kingdom to another, they did not suffer that status, but were considered fully native. So to be fully Welsh, you had to be a member of the free classes, is effectively what it's saying here, and not a serf or a slave. However, the serfs were still considered in some manner. They were still considered Welsh, and if they moved from one kingdom to another, they weren't considered foreigner. So obviously, a foreigner had a completely different status that was analogous to the status of a slave. Those from outside Wales were considered between serfs and slaves, forbidden to offer testimony and obliged to pledge themselves to a native Welshman, who could even be a serf, who would then be responsible for them. This status could only be removed after three generations in the north, and possibly as many as nine generations elsewhere, after which the foreigner's descendants were considered to be native serfs. So this is very interesting. You had to, if you wanted to move to Wales, you had to find somebody who would, a whole family that would pledge to be responsible for you. And then that family had to be responsible for you for four generations in the north. But in the fourth generation, you could be naturalized, and it could be nine generations elsewhere. Nine generations that family would have to be responsible for you before they could be considered naturalized. I mean, that is just, it's the complete opposite of what we have today, isn't it? Any thoughts on these naturalization laws here, Treefids?
Yeah, they also had this in the Bible, right? You could marry other Adamic civilizations, and then after three generations, they would become Israelite, as I said earlier. So originally that would apply to Egyptians, Persians, Assyrians, But that was only originally in the first, you know, the kingdom period and the judges. Once they got deported and came back, the Egyptians had been overrun by Nubians and become intermixed. And that's when the laws changed. So that's why there's confusion. They could no longer intermarry whenever any of the surrounding nations because they could no longer know their genealogies. But over here in England, you knew everybody was white. So it didn't matter so much. It was more just preserving the heritage and the culture. And that's why three generations was fine. You didn't have to worry about it because you knew everybody was the same race, but you just wanted to make sure that they would obey the Welsh laws or, you know, your country and you know, not bring in foreign like English from their perspective or Danish culture and try to change the country, right?
And again, it just shows you that you know, this great value that they actually placed on their culture and their nation. If anybody wants to come in and partake of that, you know, they have to find a guarantor. And even when they have a guarantor, their word is not to be trusted. You know, that they were not able to, not allowed to give testimony. So it wasn't just that they had to be pledged to a native Welshman. And it also says here native, so they understood, you know, what a native was, what an indigenous person was, but they weren't even allowed to speak in a court, not allowed to offer testimony, clearly not allowed to have any say in the laws of the country or the running of the country or the running of the nation or whatever it was. But if they showed that they were good people and had honourable intentions, which you would obviously be able to tell, over three generations or nine generations, then they would be rewarded by being given the same status as a native Welshman. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
All the laws seem to be about preservation of the nation and nation and culture, and they all kind of support each other, don't they? I mean, of course, you're not going to let someone who's just come into the country have a say, because I mean, who can really vouch for them too much or trust them? And I think if there was a family to vouch for them, then there must be a some form of foundation there, strong foundation in the first place, for this family to put their trust in that person. So it's obviously very nationalistic, weren't they?
Well, it's very clear everything is based on ancestry, isn't it? It's all based on shared ancestors. It's not based on, oh, somebody was born on this patch of ground, this patch of land. It's who your ancestors were. That determined, you know, what position you had in society. That determined, you know, what you could say in court and whether you could take part in court and the laws. And if you're outside of that, you had to prove that you had honourable intentions. And the idea that there would be somebody from some sub-Saharan Africa over here at that time is just ridiculous. You know, the foreigners that were there were the Saxons or the Danes or the Frisians. They were all people of the same race, but that were of a slightly different ethnicity. That's what was meant by the term foreigner. I think we should probably leave that here for today, though. Any final thoughts on what we've been talking about today, Truth Fids?
Well, we haven't got through it all, but notice that there's no laws on racism or anything like that. It's all the opposite, to preserve your race, your heritage. That's essentially what all these laws are, and to make sure that you know, there's no disputes and no violence, just to keep it civil. But it's all to preserve the genealogies and the race of the nation, right?
And also to preserve the peace of the society, you know, when we were talking about these laws over theft as well. Patriarch, any final thoughts on today's subject matter?
Yeah, I wish we could return to something like this, to be honest, but I don't think it'd be possible right now, would it? You know, so, yeah, it's interesting and really great to listen to how things were in the past. But it seems a bit too far gone at the moment.
Yes, it's a huge contrast, isn't it, to the way that things are today, and the way that legal system is geared today to policing people's speech rather than keeping people out, keeping outsiders out until they have demonstrated the fact that they have honourable intentions, and keeping them out for up to 9 generations. I mean, that's just, it's the complete opposite of what we have today. Anyway, thank you very much for coming on today, Truthfids.
Thanks for having me, as always, Sven.
Thank you very much for coming on today, Patriarch.
Thank you, Sven.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Friday with more patriotic history for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.